Good morning and welcome to the Monday, May 10th edition of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Natural Resources Subcommittee. Today we're continuing with House Bill 5023, which is the budget overview for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And we've continued through the portions of the presentation leading with leading up to the Fish Division. And so we'd like to bring forward Mr. Doug DeHart, Fish Division Director, along with the Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Mr. Jim Greer. And good morning. Begin whenever you're comfortable.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, for the record, again, I'm Douglas DeHart, Fish Division Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. On Thursday, I've gone over with you a brief summary of the Fish Division budget and briefly commented for you on the program areas of fish propagation, our hatchery program, and natural production, our field management native species management program. This morning I'd like to go over with you briefly the remaining two program areas of the Fish Division, which are marine resources and interjurisdictional fisheries. The first of these, marine resources, is carried out primarily out of three field offices of the department based on the Oregon coast. The program is centered at Newport, with other significant field offices at Charleston and Astoria. The program works closely with industry in collecting marine and estuarine data and analyzing it. We carry out extensive cooperative sampling with industry representatives, including chartering privately owned boats, volunteer programs, or individual fishermen collect information for us, enter it in data logs, or allow one of our biologists to gather information on board their vessel during its routine operation. A major issue in this area of the department has been the changing status of groundfish species in the last several years. That is, species like the flatfishes, the flounders, for instance, that have gone through substantial declines in numbers, and new information has shown that that these declines are somewhat larger than we or other biological organizations had estimated earlier. That's resulted in the Pacific Fishery Management Council, the council that's made up of the West Coast states and the federal agencies, to substantially downgrade the total harvestable quotas of these species. This has had serious impacts on the commercial industry on the Oregon coast and has caused significant economic impacts and dislocation in that industry.
Okay. Question of Ken Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And why did we, seemingly to me, get behind the power curve in those estimates on that? And I do know that it caused great concern and great problems on the Oregon coast with that industry. And I'm just curious if we have any reason or any about why that caught us seemingly by surprise.
Representative Jensen, there's at least two contributing reasons. One of them is there's been very little state money in the past put into inventory work on marine species. Also, relatively little federal money has been dedicated to this area in the past compared, for instance, to sampling of salmon in fresh water. We weren't collecting a large volume of data on many of these species, sablefish black cod being an excellent example of a species that's been harvested for many years, but very little biological data on the status of the population until recently. The second answer to that question, I think, if you compare what's happened on the Oregon coast to, let's say, the Gulf of Alaska or the Bering Sea, in that area, the marine industry, along with fishery managers, a number of years ago, moved toward a system of observers on every vessel, every larger vessel, and actually one-third of smaller vessels to gather a large amount of biological information. This was actually paid for by assessments to industry. Our industry here has been slower to come around to supporting ideas of that sort. Of course, in fairness, it costs significant money, and the fleet down here is largely made up of smaller vessels and smaller companies or partnerships in ownership of those vessels, so that approach would pose a more difficult hardship here, but that is the other way this problem has been solved in other parts of the country. Having said that, though, in fairness, there is a tendency with marine programs to, as long as things are going well, you know, people trust the small amount of information they had. When you realize you have a problem, then you start to push more resources into it, and we're all playing catch up a little bit there right now, if you're going to mention.
That's fair, Mitchell.
Well, I just was wanting to follow and inquire as to whether there's any speculation about ocean conditions, as whether that has been a contributing factor to the cause.
Oh, certainly, Representative Jensen. The same factor with upwelling and this El Nino effect that you read about in the papers also affects marine species because it affects the availability of small bait fishes and shrimps that these fish species too grow up on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. DeHart, we've been dating the fiber optics lines in the ocean and through the fishing beds, I think since 1994, maybe beyond that, when the negotiations were starting. As we were dealing with the AT&T's line coming in between Bend and Coos Bay here in the last month or so, it was really obvious the lack of participation of the fisheries, ODF&W, as far as helping the fishermen present their case and the data of what the impact of those beds being taken out of production for the fishermen and those kind of things. Could you explain to me and this committee why the department wasn't prepared for that scenario and what your plans are in the future with the future fiber optics lines coming in?
Representative Messerly, I will try to answer your question, though I would ask too that when Kay Brown, our habitat chief, is presenting to you, that she cover this area for you too, because this is an area where they have the program lead. But our marine program people have been closely involved in these discussions, so I'll answer the question from that perspective. Indeed, we have joined the discussions. We have attempted to present the information we have on sensitive areas, and we have argued for the idea that there should be relatively few designated corridors for such communication lines. So we have both a minimum habitat disruption and also just the placing of these cables causes a problem with the operation of bottom trawl gear, of course, and other types of fishing gear that might become entangled, and there's a substantial liability to fishermen. So you designate corridors that fishermen do not set their gear in for that reason. So we have been involved. We have shared the information which we have available here. Our information is limited, and our marine habitat program is very small, but we are involved.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Have you developed data as to the economic impacts to the coastal communities, to the sports fisheries, as well as the commercial fisheries, by the laying of these cables in certain areas? And have you been involved in the negotiations to find ways to mitigate and mediate problems that are caused by the cables?
Representative Messer, we haven't developed economic data on the impact of these cabling systems. From my perspective, at least, I believe that's because we simply have incomplete information to do that. We have been involved, our marine program has been involved in discussions about mitigation actions and about possible, as I say, corridors and ways of laying the cable that will have minimum impact.
Mr. Chair, could I switch to another topic that I covered previously? Mr. DeHart, we've heard last session figures as to the relationship of quality habitat to the number of salmon
on the Oregon coast. Could you give us an update? I believe it was there was seven times more habitat than there were salmon returning as the figures we heard last session. We've had an awful lot of work done in the last 2 years. Could you give us an update as to what kind of numbers we're looking at at this time, and also a number as to the same issue statewide?
Representative Messerly, I'll answer the question primarily in relation to Oregon coastal coho. It's a more difficult question for us to answer statewide at this point because our Oregon plant inventory program hasn't been expanded to many parts of the state yet, and in those areas where steelhead are the primary issue, we historically have not had very good information on numbers and density because of the way they're sampled in fisheries and the time at which they spawn, which is to say in the winter to early spring in freshets. In the case of coho, though, which is, I believe, the reference you were making to number of spawners versus amount of habitat, the estimates that you saw, we looked at the total available habitat and said, okay, how many fish can that support in good conditions? How many spawners per mile? And the present number of spawners, as you point out, is substantially below that. In the last 2 years, that has not coastwide materially changed. The number of coho spawning in south and south central coast areas, as Senator Tarno knows, have been relatively good in recent years. And in the southern area, we are very close to our estimates of total production capability of some of our habitats. But when you get up into the Middle Coast area, Lincoln County, for instance, and then further north, our numbers still remain quite low. We're hopeful that with this turnaround in ocean conditions we're clearly seeing right now as we speak, that will start paying benefits for us very quickly. But I'd caution you, too, you can't simply look at those number ratios and say, well, gosh, that means we've got seven times more habitat than we need, or if we had seven times more spawners, everything would be good, because the limiting factor on the Oregon coast isn't the amount of spawning habitat. It's the amount of rearing habitat for juvenile fish. That's where we're putting all of our effort into habitat restoration, not into creating more spawning habitat, because that's not limiting our numbers. When you have years like these last several years, where you have small numbers of fish returning, what happens is, of course, the juvenile fish move into the very best habitat and have the very best survival in those years. So even in those years, the quality of habitat is very important. You can't just say, well, we got some habitat over here that's not being used fully right now, so improving habitat isn't important in those situations. In the areas where we're carrying out habitat improvement, we're seeing increased juvenile rearing density, so clearly we are having a positive effect right now. But I readily admit we're not going to see the full payoff until we see those total numbers of returns start to bounce up with increased ocean survival. So there's a little bit of a waiting game.
What I'm trying to get is an indication as to whether our, not only your department, many other departments, forestry and ag and all of them, but the volunteer efforts, if we're being successful. An indication of, from your perspective as a manager of the fish division, if there's some way that you can give us an indication as to whether we're making progress on that habitat, and if so, how much.
Representative Messerly, I can't quantify the how much for you. Certainly, my judgment, as I said, is based on the information on increased juvenile rearing densities, is yes, we're making progress. We're producing benefits. Our monitoring program, though, is geared in toward identifying and quantifying trends over several years. So it's going to take us several years before we can say, well, we invested this much money and we produced this many more fish because of it. That question I can't answer today.
Sure, just a summary statement on my part. I read a report last night from the IMSC team. And I think they were talking exactly about my concern right here. We don't have a way of measuring whether we're making progress or whether our monitoring is showing an indication that we're moving in the right direction. I would hope that as we reflect this budget, we can consider that it seems to me like it's the type of a situation where we continue to spend more time, more money, more effort, and we really don't know where we're going with this, and we don't know whether we're making progress or how much. I don't believe that measuring fish should be the measurement, or how many fish return should be the measurement, but we should be able to talk about water quality and habitat, and we've, many of us have been frustrated for some time that we don't have a database and where we can compile how much habitat is improved, how much it was improved, how much spawning beds are opened up, and that kind of information. So I think this discussion has pointed out very clearly to me, at least, that we're really dealing with kind of a black hole, and we need much better indications and data as we proceed.
Further questions or comments from the committee?
Sir, could you, Chair, then to wrap up the discussion in the Marine Resources Program. Another area of challenge and attention in the next several years in this program is going to be a move toward individual fishery quotas coastwide. The dislocation in the ground fish industry, the decline in commercial salmon, and the move there into other fisheries, including the rockfish species, has put a great deal of pressure in open access fisheries where all boats participate equally and essentially engage in a derby to see who can catch enough fish to stay in business and who can't. There is a federal moratorium now on the institution of new programs that allocate specific quotas to individual commercial fishermen. That moratorium expires in another year. There is building support in the industry to develop and test such a program. This is really a new and different viewpoint, I think, among many in the industry here. I think they've come to it reluctantly, simply recognizing the economic situation that they are faced with. But I expect over the next 3 to 4 years, this issue of identifying and assigning individual quotas, which may be transferable from fisherman to fisherman under some set of rules, is going to occupy a great deal of our time and dialogue with the fishing industry in the state. So in carrying out...
President Council?
Let me ask you a couple of questions, because this is a hugely controversial issue, how this is going to be adapted. But recently, the Department of Fish and Wildlife took a plan that was adopted, and I'm not sure where it came from, to adjust the ground fish quotas into the months of January, February, and March. If you're in a situation in a port like mine, which had a bad bar because of the breakdown of the North Jetty and tough winter conditions, literally the whole port hardly went fishing at all. And when you shifted that fish there, you took the fish away from those fishermen and moved it to another port, particularly California, or a deep water port like the Columbia River or Puget Sound. How did the Department of Fish and Wildlife go in and allow this to happen? Because now those fishermen in that port lose those fish now into perpetuity because of the shift.
Representative Thompson, As you understand, this discussion and this decision happened within the Fishery Management Council, not by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, but of course we were a participant. The logic here for the rest of the committee was to move in the direction of spreading the fishery out so fishermen didn't have to essentially operate over a very small period in a race for fish, but the quota was spread out over several months. The hope was that this would reduce some of the derby effect. And it's, in a way, of course, a small move toward in the same direction that fishery quotas try to accomplish. What's wrong with it, potentially, as Representative Thompson says, is local conditions in one area versus another can work toward the advantage of one portion of the fleet versus another. I think in the short term, the answer will be to fine-tune this system of monthly quotas, but again, I suspect that this is going to focus some of the discussion on individual quotas in the future.
Follow-up.
Was there any thought as to the shift of resources away from the state of Oregon, and do you have the numbers when you came in and testified in the council in support or opposition? I could see a situation where we lost millions of pounds forever in this state. I don't have the numbers in front of me because of that change.
Representative Thompson, certainly in our discussions in the council, we attempt to protect and advocate for Oregon's fisheries and Oregon's fishery share. We did not have information in front of us that showed a substantial loss of fishery share to Oregon fishermen in this discussion, but with when the discussion occurred. With documentation, clearly we're going to try to address that.
Can I make a comment?
Absolutely.
Well, it worries me when we go into a program like this that we're talking about millions of dollars and millions of pounds, that we don't have that kind of planning in advance of a state view when we go in and adopt something like this. It could potentially cost us millions and millions of dollars to the fishermen of this state. And I didn't see a plan from the Department of Fish and Wildlife how that affects us in the heat.
Representative Thompson, I don't need to tell you how the Pacific Fishery Management Council works. I understand that you've been a participant in those actions long enough. You probably understand it as well as I. But the economic and scientific analysis is done by the council's committees. We participate, but with a very small sliver of resources, we really don't have the ability to do an independent economic analysis at that time.
For sure.
I'd like to request the department's presentation to the council on this issue with green discussion. Evidently, you did make a presentation to the State Fisheries Council.
Yes, Representative Messer, we can provide a transcript of our testimony to the council on this issue.
You just provide that to Rocco. He'll make sure that committee members all get it. And if I could ask that it be courtesy copy to Representative Thompson also.
Mr. Chair, I guess my question would be, I mean, what is your recollection of your testimony? Did you acknowledge the to the marine fisheries the problem that that would create for Newport?
We were not aware at that time that it would cause a shift of this kind.
Mr. Chair,
follow up.
Who did you contact in the fisheries community before you testified?
We worked with a group of representatives of the commercial industry, as we do on all issues, to seek their advice and input to us in advance. And of course, the process here is that individual fishermen and marketing associations and other members of the industry testify themselves before the council as well on an issue of this sort. Thanks.
That was fantastic.
And let me say one thing in their benefit. They have made a change in trying to, before a council meeting, which is really the vision of this resource, they've stepped forward now and tried to make contact through making individual port contacts previous to the council. This is something new they haven't done in advance because of some of the problems they've created. There's also one other factor, though, that did come from this shift in the fisheries. Traditionally, we've gone on a month-by-month division. When they grouped 3 months together and then shifted more into the early quota, it allowed the Alaska boats that were involved in the pollock fishery to go out and target on brown rock. Consequently, in a few days, they caught a huge amount of fish, which brought the market down, which created a windfall profit for the processors. Today, there's a lot more effort by processors to create these kind of things, so they make these windfall profits. Now those Alaska boats are back in the pollock fishery. They've got a pulse on it. They're all of a sudden in the brown rock fishery, which was one of the things that was helping make this local fleet survive. There's a whole bunch of these problems, and I'm not sure that they're being fully examined before these decisions are being made, and that's all I'm saying.
Mr. Thompson, the pattern is fairly clear. The fleet is an opportunistic entity. It moves on to different target fisheries as the opportunity arises. But the coordination between the regulatory agencies and the fleet simply isn't taking place in light of the rapidity with which the fleet can change and retarget itself. So it looks like everybody's chasing the bubble all the time. But that's because there's no comprehensive discussions between the agency as the regulatory organization and the industry, which is the regulated. And I say no, I guess I obviously don't mean that there isn't any point of discussion. It just seems that there's no coordination between the demand and supply and the regulation curve. And just displacing that opportunity north and south on the coast isn't what I consider sustainable management from the concept of the individual-based fishery.
I wanted to, he won't say himself, but the present director has taken steps to try to improve this situation.
Oh, he might jump in there.
Looking for a segue here.
I've got to pat him on the back here a little bit.
Mr. Chair, I might make a point that I think what Representative Thompson is referring to is that we've initiated an annual meeting with the entire commercial fleet and industry, processing and fishermen themselves, on an annual basis. And then in addition to that, we're going to meet prior to any specific Fishery Management Council meeting, make sure that everybody has an opportunity to put out their issues on the table with our department biologists so that we're all at least cognizant of what each other's concerns are prior to going in to those meetings with any kind of a recommendation. And, of course, there's members of the industry on that council as well. So we're almost forced to be in constant communication. The part that was a letdown, though, I think, in these past years is that we haven't had this kind of a full meal deal in terms of reviewing all of the issues for the industry prior to getting to those Pacific Fishery Management Council meetings, and there's very little time to really walk through those and make sure we can address as many of those issues as we can. So that's why we've initiated these upfront meetings on an annual basis.
Well, the only question I've got is annually frequent enough. In the idea that the fishermen are entrepreneurs and they tend to be very strategic about and competitive about staying in business. And I just wonder if the agency has the ability to keep up with the industry in terms of its need to change and be adaptable. And so it looks to me like a more comprehensive approach would be better, and I don't know, does a meeting a year get the job done, or is it a bigger job than that?
The way the council is structured, oh, it's a great answer.
Well, I think what was initiated that we haven't had in the past was one primary meeting with the entire industry. But in addition to that, on a regular basis, prior to any Pacific Fishery Management Council meeting, we'll have a sit-down session with those communities that are affected by whatever decisions are coming up at that meeting. And then one other thing we've just initiated with our commission, and that is actually identifying a subcommittee of commissioners that are going to be tracking all of these commercial fishery issues so that they're more involved and they have a better sense of understanding of what those issues are and what the impact of their decisions will be.
Let me confess, there's one problem in this. For years, the fishermen were involved, but they've kind of been forced out of the council process, particularly the smaller boats. It became almost entirely involved and absorbed in the whiting fishery. So the smaller trawlers and a lot of the smaller boats were kind of excluded from the process. And part of it's because the council moves up and down around the state. And it costs a lot of money. If you go 3 days in Sacramento, you're going to have $500, and plus you're going to lose 3 days of your fishing time. It gets very expensive to go testify at these council meetings. Unless the department does something like this to allow input and make an effort to get a hold of these smaller boats, they will soon be excluded from the fishery, because if you're not there, you will lose.
Representative Mitchell and then Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While you're compiling the information that we just asked for on this issue, could you present us also with the data that the department has in regards to the fiber optics and that you've presented to the different meetings and levels, and also the date in which you presented that? And Mr. Chair, the bottom line here is that I don't see that the department is an advocate for the industries, whether it's sport or commercial. And when we get into these kind of problems with the council or dealing with fiber optics or whatever, it seems to me that the department ought to be there shoulder to shoulder with the industries, at least presenting the information, the economic information, what it does to the resource and this type of thing. And I'm concerned that it appears to me, at least, that the department is kind of after the fact, trying to catch up to what's really going on out there. And I think that's important that State of Oregon is helping those industries present their case and helping those communities that are impacted present their case as to what's happening to them and as well as to the fishermen.
Okay. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope everyone gets a copy of the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Journal and reads the transcript from the joint salmon committee meeting, and what that paper showing, because there's some real interesting things in there. I'd like to ask a couple questions relative to it. One of the things that was asked is, why was this run being eliminated on the LC? And the answer was that because of the 600 seals and sea lions. And yet when we had a bill that was a meager attempt to just request from the Department of Commerce that we'd be able to manage that population, we received a letter of opposing the bill from ODF&W. My first question is why?
Senator George, as you recall, we answered your earlier question with a fairly detailed explanation of the reason for the changes in the operation at Alcee Hatchery. Our motivation or the reason for this change was not the presence of seals or sea lions in Alcee Bay. It was the fact that we have had relatively little opportunity for harvest of hatchery coho coast-wide over the last several years and have downsized our coastal hatchery coho program substantially, reducing numbers of fish produced or eliminating entire brood stocks in many areas, falling back to maintaining a relatively small number of brood stocks, five of them, coast-wide as the basis for a potential future coho program. The broodstock at Alcee was not one of the ones we chose to maintain because of its relatively low return rate in recent years. Eliminating that broodstock at this time, of course, led to the surplus situation this last year and will lead to some surpluses this year as well. At Alcee, our intention is to develop a new broodstock in this basin that is that has characteristics more like the local wild broodstock, so it can also be used for supplementation outplanting in the future. Those are our primary reasons for the action. As you say, we do believe there is a significant mortality problem, including harbor seal feeding on juvenile coho as they move through that system, and we're using this as an opportunity to collect information on that in a situation where we won't have as many hatchery juveniles present. But that wasn't the reason for our change.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Follow up. That wasn't answer my question. But the other issue is that the 600 seals is a number that was given by Bob Buckman, who is of course at the Mid Coast District. One of the other questions that I'd like to ask as a follow up to that is in relationship to the STEP program. When it was asked why aren't we enhancing this program, and the answer was given that quote, this program has fallen out of favor, and never was answered out of favor with who or whom.
Senator George, I don't believe I would use that term. The STEP program today is at its largest level of activity and the largest number of participating volunteers, hearkening back to the days that it was created. It certainly is true to say that the STEP program today is more diverse in what it does, rather than simply focusing primarily on hatchbox and small pond rearing programs. A lot more habitat work and inventory work being done by that program, but we still continue to successfully use hatchboxes, for instance, in areas where we have good habitat that doesn't have spawners, and we have available broodstock. The problem in the LC at this point is the number of broodfish is so small that we have to get those numbers back up, first of all, to even have eggs to work with programs like this.
I was told last week that the actual STEP program today, the Hatchbox program, is literally demonstration boxes that are carried around to different school districts to talk about it. What is the total number of boxes and streams as compared to, say, 5 years ago or 2 years ago? Or something? The peak point of our Hatchbox process.
Senator George, I don't have numbers for you. I'll get those and get those back to you. It is true that there are a smaller number of total hatch boxes in use at this time because we are using locally available broodstocks now for all of our hatch box programs and are not bringing in eggs from outside of an area. So in many cases, we simply can't locate suitable eggs for some of those programs. But we're certainly carrying out still an extensive number of hatch box programs for the purpose of run restoration. We also do use hatch boxes for educational demonstration projects, as you mentioned, primarily in conjunction with school districts and the like, so children get a better idea just what the rearing cycle looks like and better understand what the needs of the fish are. That's correct.
Mr. Chairman, just one quick comment. One of the disturbing things, as Representative Thompson pointed out, is that with a diminishing supply, we know what the results are going to be for our fishermen. They're going to get less and less. We're taking the same pie and we're dividing it into smaller and smaller pieces. And the thing that bothers me is I look at the questions and the answers, and as I try to examine this whole process, it looks to me that we're actually intentionally reducing the supply. We're not doing anything about predation. We're not doing anything about improving the process. In other words, there's a quote in here. Some people argue that even touching two wild fish, a male and a female, makes them not wild. And that defies every kind of logic I've ever heard of. But anyway, the point of this is that if we can't address those foundational problems about how do we restore the hatchery process, whether it's the in-stream natural or whether it's the fact that we recognize we have five fish and we're going to maximize that, we're not going to take 10% maturity of the fish, we're going to take 90% through the hatchery. If we don't address that, these folks are out of business. And one more industry on the coast. When their fishery collapses, so does the port. The port collapses. And I want to hear from you. I want to hear some direction. We're going to stand firm in defense of our fishermen when it comes to who gets what percentage of what hatch that's remaining. And we're going to stand firm to make sure that we increase the number of fish that are going to stay in returning. And are we going to hear that?
Well, Senator George, I think you're not only going to hear it, you have been hearing it from us. You saw in the papers the debate recently about establishing an opportunity for a demonstration selective coho sport fishery in the ocean off the central coast of Oregon. There we tried to strike a balance, and I think a good balance, between protecting Oregon coast natural wild coho on one hand, better accessing Oregon's hatchery fish when they're available to be caught, and doing it in a way that generates good information. We were strong advocates for what we thought was a biologically sound approach to that in that case, and that's where we'll be in the future, too.
I was going to pass the table thing. For me, it's like, oh boy, which cherry do I pick on the tree first? In the case of undersea cable, since I was involved in that, and I understand, you know, you guys didn't have a staff person or didn't seem to be keeping up with what was going on. It worries me that the Department of Fish and Wildlife wasn't aware or didn't seem to be directly involved, because if we don't have miles of bottom to fish, we also lose the income, and that also affects your budget. Yet I didn't see them in there fighting to make sure that we were allowed to keep access to the bottom. I'll let you respond to that, and then I have another question.
Certainly, Representative Thompson, you understand our marine program quite well and know most of the people involved in it. So, you know, part of the answer is there are darn few warriors to fight this war. We don't have a big staff of people that go out there and track marine habitat issues. We have a very small group of people where that's one of many of their responsibilities. Now, in fairness to you, of course, you're one of the people that's worked very hard to help us find resources to do that sort of thing. But at this point, we're doing it with darn few people and darn little money, and that means some things we get behind on them, realize they're an issue, and then we reprogram and focus some of those swim efforts that we've got into them, and that's really what happened here.
I guess I get to ask the second question then. And
well, I'll let you go ahead.
Thank you. We hear rumors of another cable laying ship in China. We hear rumors of a Fuxun cable that's going to arc up the coast. And another point of access, every one of these cables will reduce towable bottom unless they're negotiated in properly. And we've made the step now, and the governor's made the step by saying renewable resources still are in the lead. But in every one of these cases, there has to be somebody shifted or someone to fight the fight as to the economic situation that develops inside of your department. It seems like to me, rather than have a person just run around and be biologically orientated, that in a case of something like this, which could destroy individual fisheries as a whole, that that would become a priority.
Representative Thompson, certainly I think it's fair to say we have focused in on the submerged cable issue and are advocating strongly for the use of a very few corridors where all future cables are routed through those same corridors so we don't create new areas of impact. And we're working closely with the governor's office and with other state agencies involved in this issue to gain the support of that point of view. That's the approach we're taking.
I'll make this as a comment, and that's that from now, this point forward, I hope that when we have an application for a cable, right after the application comes the economic loss to the fishery. I mean, if anybody can produce it, your department needs to produce that so that we have numbers to work with.
We will certainly continue to argue and advocate for that, Representative Thompson.
And Representative Thompson, we learned that earlier with our hearings with the Division of State Lands, that Oregon has no provision for acquiring any franchise fee, management cost recapture mechanism for permitting cable laying. And virtually every other entity that has jurisdiction or authority over that has some sort of recapture mechanism, and some are fairly lucrative royalty agreements. So something that intersects with management costs for holding the kind of discussions and coordination that we are referring to. Right now, there's no mechanism for that kind of necessary coordination. That's one opportunity to pay for that process. So,
and remember now, I'm kind of stuck in a fisherman mode and a politician mode. I want to explain.
Where's the rock?
The tower. As a fisherman, I don't like to see any fee charged for use of the bottom that isn't direct. And particularly, when you go outside of 3 miles, it's federal water, you can't do it. But as the politician side of me says, oh, yes, there's some money there, and we need to be able to have a fair market value for that established and the procedure in the law to do it. So I'm split, but wherever the body wants to go, I think that's your decision.
Well, let's be real clear on something, Mr. Thompson. I would let you carry the bill on the new tax.
I'm going to try to say.
But what we've learned is that coastal communities that are, in fact, proximate to the cable don't have access to the C1 connectors that would make their community accessible to the information highway that may just be, you know, literally a few yards offshore. The other thing is that there are some issues of coordinating to minimize the impact on local industries of laying the cable. And that certainly is a management expense. It's reasonable. So I think this argument is essential.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. DeHart, as I look through your organization and look through your packages, when we had presentation from the Wildlife Division, they had a department within their division that dealt with habitat and implementation and production of habitat. I don't find that in your division, and I'm concerned about the coordination between the Habitat Division and your division. I believe it's true that your fish biologist is doing an awful lot of work on developing habitat with both the department, with prison labor, and with volunteers. And yet I don't see where there's any coordination within your department to deal with it. I believe what I heard earlier in presentation was that the Habitat Division deals with the coordination of the government agencies and the federal agencies that are concerned to develop mitigation and those kind of things. Does your staff in fact work on habitat? And where is that reflected in your budget?
Representative Messerly, in both our marine resources program, one we're discussing now, and in our natural production program, our field biologists gather information on habitat status. They gather information relative to the possible effects of a permitted action. And in the case of our natural production program, as you observe, through the Oregon Plan and other programs, they partner with local landowners, local businesses, and others for habitat restoration activities. So we did substantial on-the-ground work. That statewide coordination, that creation of statewide policies, and the work at a policy level with other state agencies is done through our Habitat Division, which acts as the department's statewide policy coordinator. Our coordination and information flow with them is quite good, and our biologists work with the statewide coordinators in our Habitat Division on a daily basis.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up?
Follow up, and then
could you go in more depth about the coordination and communication is quite good. How exactly does the Habitat Division reach to your staff on the ground and in the field?
Well, Representative Messerly, it's probably best to pick an example. It might be a gravel removal issue, for instance, where the Habitat Division has a statewide coordinator that works with the Division of State Lands on policies and on criteria and guidelines. Have developed maps of areas or critical resource protection, and then when an individual project comes along, one of our biologists in the field will actually go out, look at the site. They will visit with the landowner. They will talk about whether there are adjustments in the proposal that might deal with or reduce any adverse impacts of that. They coordinate their recommendations with our Habitat Division and explain the information that they have developed and their discussions with landowners. Then if there are policy issues to be resolved, they discuss that between them before our formal comments are submitted. In that case, it would be to the Division of State Lands.
Sure. That sounds like a great
speaking. Does that in fact happen on every school?
Representative Messerly, it happens to some degree on every permit. Certainly there are examples, since we handle thousands of actions every year, where we gather this kind of information and follow through on it. Certainly there have been examples where there have been lapses in information sharing or coordination, but I think it's fair to say that those are very much the exception and not the rule.
Sure. I think that what is lacking in this department at this time in regards to this issue is the lack of policy and sideboards as to what the staff can do prior to, I mean, I totally understand that you can't go through that total process on every permit. But from my experience and what I've heard from constituents, there's not a policy that gives you certain guidelines for this type of operation, that type of operation. And then if you have a specific case,
then you have a process that you go outside, you go to your superiors and have that division, and I think it's caused a lot of confusion, and it lacks consistency in the program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to go back to the comment on the hatch box again, and maybe make a comment on that if Mr. Behart would like to react to that decline. But he made the comment when Senator George was asking about the decline in the hatch box program that you referred to the, you know, the lack of brood stock for being used. And since I am a hatch box operator on the Sandy River system at Mount Hood, we have not had eggs for the five boxes that are running the Sandy River system the last 2 years. But it has not been because of the lack of broodstock. They come out of the Clackamas region, and the reason it's been given is because of the wild fish policy. And 5 years ago, in starting to do, I've been involved in this for over 10 years, but 5 years ago, we started taking the fry when they were hatched and were instructed to take them below Marmot Dam because of the wild fish policy. And now we're not getting eggs at all, not because of not the availability of eggs for spring chinook or summer steelhead, but was because of the wild fish policy, is why we are not operating those hatch boxes.
Senator Metzger, I think the answer is a little more complicated than just to say the wild fish policy, but the answer certainly has been decisions by our commission to move the impacts of hatchery stocks to the lower portion of the Sandy system below Marmot Dam, and eliminate those influences above Marmot Dam and try to maintain and rebuild the genetic type that is native to that area. That's good wild fish management, whether we had a wild fish policy or not. Since we've got endangered species listings in that area, of course, it's also federal policy whether we had a wild fish policy or not. We believe we're doing the right thing here, but we're also trying to exercise good judgment in how we manage hatchery stocks, both for rebuilding numbers and for fishing opportunities in parts of the basin, and still meet some of these endangered species requirements in other parts. It's a bit of a tightrope that we and our commission are trying to walk, and we're feeling our way here, but that's been the reason for our decisions. That's now a little more complicated, of course, by discussions about the possible removal of Marmot Dam. And we're not at all sure what that will mean then if we no longer have a semi-barrier between the two portions of the basin.
Mr. Chair, whether you call it a policy or not, I think it's just important to note that you know, your comment was that we were reducing the hatch box because of the unavailability of sufficient broodstock. And all I'm saying is in this case, it was not the unavailability of broodstock. It was a decision that was made. And you know, one could argue whether that's a good decision or a bad decision, but I think it would be a misnomer to say just because we didn't have broodstock to provide eggs for those boxes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Metzger, we've heard a lot of circular arguments in this and other committees about policy. And I think you just identified one of the circular arguments. You know, we have a decision based on a policy. It de-emphasizes a particular activity, therefore, you know, you can build any syllogism you want to out of that. The point is that it better be understandable and intelligent enough to explain to lay people. It better be simple enough, yet serviceable enough to achieve objectives that are measurable, because those are the criteria that the legislature, if they haven't already, will set on the wild fish issue. I don't agree that it isn't as simple as a wild fish policy. Maybe as simple as collaboration with co-managers. And Mr. Duhart, you were describing the Sandy River system. There's a new hatchery system or a new hatchery process in Corbett. What is the coordination mechanism between the co-managers that are operating the hatchery in Corbett and the department management of the Sandy River system in the lower Columbia or the mid-Columbia there? How do we get together and coordinate? Because they have co-managers operating a fish hatchery in Corbett.
Mr. Chair, I'm a little confused. I don't know of a facility operating in Corbett. We do have a co-management steelhead program on the lower Hood River in the Powerdale area. That's the closest one to that area that I'm aware of.
Okay. Well, where's the new facility that the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs has just opened up?
That is the site of Powerdale, where there's both adult collection and handling facilities and now a juvenile rearing facility just outside of Hood River, the town of Hood River.
Okay. Maybe my geography is bad, but the facility is the one I'm referring to. How do we coordinate our management policies with that hatchery?
We work very closely with the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation. We jointly developed the proposal for funding of that activity, jointly took it to the National Marine Fisheries Service and to the North West Power Planning Council and got DPA money to pay for it. We jointly designed a monitoring and evaluation program, which is now partially carried out by our biologists and partially carried out by the biologists of the Warm Springs Tribe. So all of our actions there have been jointly agreed to.
It should be hard to say, is there a marking mechanism, tip tags or adipose fin clipping, or how do the Warm Springs differentiate their hatchery stock from other stock?
Senator Arioli, those fish are marked both with wire nose tags for evaluation purposes and with the adipose fin clip to identify the supplementation program.
And Mr. Hart, what stocks are being supplemented?
Both summer and winter run steelhead in the Hood River system above Powerdale.
I guess the existence of the tribal interest here, and we've had testimony from representatives of the Nez Perce, indicate they have a less than cooperative relationship with the agency and, in fact, litigated a couple cases and are about to go to court on another one. And I wondered how there should be such a disparate view of coordination between tribal interests and the department. Because I hear you saying that there's close coordination and maybe it's different tribal interests that are coming into play. But I hear from you it's very close coordination. The committee heard last week that the relations between some of the co-managers is at a breaking point.
Senator Ferriola, I think it's fair to say that we have differing working relationships with individual tribes. Our co-management relationship on supplementation projects with the Warm Springs tribe, I would characterize as excellent. Certainly, we have had several disputes in the past with the Nez Perce tribe concerning some of their supplementation proposals in the Grand Ronde and the Minnehaha system. And as you rightly say, that took us to court last year to resolve one of those disputes. So we worked very closely with the Nez Perce tribe this year. There was concern earlier that dispute would have to be resolved in court. We successfully resolved it with each other by discussion and negotiation for this year for management in the Minnehaha system, and we're working closely with the tribe and hope to be able to do that next year. So we're certainly working together in good faith. That may not get us by all of our disagreements, but we're trying hard.
Colleagues, we have floor session in the Senate at at 9:40, so we better be moseying along to our respective desks. And this is a fascinating area, and I'm concerned that we're going to be doing more and more of the substantive questions, and maybe some of this will be referred to our public hearing on Tuesday around the phone and this year. And I hope, colleagues, that you've been able to take a look at your schedules and if you're able to be at that hearing, that's important. Otherwise, those members that can attend will hold the conversation.
Sure, I think at some point in time before Mr. DeHart wraps up the discussion, talk about predation, seals, maybe your thoughts on Section 188, Doug, and what's going on with the predation issue.
Certainly, Senator Kahn, I'll be prepared to do that tomorrow if the committee wishes.
Okay. Further questions or final questions from the committee?
We're going to do water and land use on Tuesday.
I'm not going to need to answer the second, but what I got in the queue to ask about is that in that governor's budget report, the fish division, reflecting the conversation we had earlier before, the fish marine resources program, that's got 78 FTE. And, we're hearing that you're thin, and so you're not able to do the work to support, the concerns that the questions were about, and it seems like a lot of folks there. And it goes on to say that we've got to respond to the ESA in so it makes me think that, you know, somehow maybe the commercial fishermen have got, you know, their resources shortened by having to, over time, move in more and more resources. And so the same issues that we asked earlier about how much the sport fishermen are getting out of their licenses for the products they're getting, and it seems like, you know, maybe we've got the same issue occurring. And that then the next bullet is the fish jurisdictional fisheries program, which also, I think, you know, gets back to the questions that we're asking. But I see that that's primarily addressed at Columbia, and that this is responsible for indigenous international management councils. So I would think that, you know, all of the fisheries that we have that send fish to their anatomists, you know, get involved in international issues, not just at Columbia, even though certainly there's more jurisdictions that have them on that.
That's right. That's
and
right.
And there were no,
it does include ocean salmon management.
And there was no money attached to that particular bullet, where, as you know, it did explain where the others were. And so maybe if you could help out on that next session.
Surely, but the quick answer is that most of our data collection is done out of our marine program, while our management coordination is done by our interjurisdictional group. So the most expensive part of it is collecting the data, and we do it as much as possible.
Colleagues, in view of the Senate session, probably being called to order as we speak, and the House session at 10 o'clock, we're going to adjourn today. And tomorrow we have Mr. Rocco.
Mr. Chair, we will continue with the Fish Division tomorrow, and perhaps get into the Habitat Division at our regular scheduled 8:30 time, and then we have an additional meeting from 1 to 4 for public testimony.
With that, we are adjourned.